The budget should be balanced, the treasury should be refilled, the public debt should be reduced, and the arrogance of public officials should be controlled. So said Ross Perot, the American business magnate who was born during the Depression and so was shaped during economic devastation. In February, Finance Minister Tito Mboweni leaned on his predecessor Trevor Manuel's past in another decision to hand out plums in the times of plenty, and arrived in Parliament with these aloe ferox from last February, looking a little worse for the wear. He continued with the farming analogy to remind his cabinet colleagues that aloes actually need less water. Well, scarcely would he have imagined that he'd be returning in June, most assumptions in tatters thanks to an invisible foreign enemy, the fiscal well running dry. Now, depending on who you talk to, this year's contraction in GDP will be anywhere from -7% to -14%. The hardy aloe is dying, but as the aloe sheds dead weight to survive, the market certainly hopes that the dead weight of ideology will finally be stripped away to prune this economy for growth and revival come spring. Is that too much to ask for? Well, let's introduce our panel to preview this decisive moment. Dr. Miriam Altman, Director of Altman Advisory and National Planning Commissioner. Kaz Kuvadia, CEO of Business Unity South Africa. Matthew Parks, Parliamentary Coordinator for COSATU. Keith Engel, Chief Executive of the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. And Peter Attard-Montalto, Head of Capital Markets Research at Intellidex. Miriam, set the scene for us here. Lots has changed since February. Revenue shortfall has gaped to roughly 300 billion. But the centerpiece of this special budget will be how the finance minister plans to fund the government's 500 billion rand COVID-19 relief package. The 200 billion rand loan guarantee scheme really is fiscally neutral, and a further 130 billion will be scraped off existing budgets. So only 170 roughly billion in new money still needs to be found. Where is that likely to come from?
I think the first thing to say is that I'm not sure that he's needing to fill a 500 billion rand hole, although the others may have a different view. 200 billion of the 500 billion package is a loan guarantee scheme, which hasn't been touched heavily yet. So there's no doubt that there's going to be a revenue shortfall, and that's really what has to be thought about. We know that the Treasury's now going to the international, the multilateral development banks like the IMF, the AFDB, the NDB, a group that Peter's part of, that I coordinate, that I've been convening, has also been proposing the idea of a sovereign social bond that relies on ESG funds. So finding the money is one side. The second side is whether there's going to be sufficient support to make sure that the economy keeps going, because the critical thing here is the revenue side. There, you know, and I think sometimes we mix up raising money, like there's tax and there's loans and other ways of getting money, but actually the only thing that matters is the tax revenue and getting it back on track. Thank goodness Edward Kiswitter is there at the helm, but otherwise we've got to work out how we're getting the economy moving, how we get firms across on the other way, paying tax again. And, you know, that will actually be the critical thing, and whether we have sufficient mechanisms in place to make sure that we don't end up with new eruptions of the virus so that we have to lock down again.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I don't think there is 500 billion. I said it's 170 odd billion because that 200 billion scheme is fiscally neutral, and because of the borrowing we're going to be doing from those multilateral institutions. But Kaz, to bring business in on this point, there's little room for magical thinking. There's been talk about QE. Thank goodness we've got Lesetha Kanyago as a very firm Reserve Bank governor who's holding forth against just opening the taps and printing money. But what would you like to see as business to ensure that capital can see a greater return on equity by investing in this economy, which we need to do to get growth going, to get tax receipts going, versus parking their money in a government bond, for example, or looking for growth offshore?
Look, I think that to a certain extent, what we have been telling government for the last few years, which is to actually create an environment through some significant intervention in the economy to create an environment for investment, both local and international investment, and on the back of that to get growth going at sufficient levels for us to actually address the socioeconomic problems we have. That's what we've been telling government for the last three to four years. What COVID has essentially done, it's just exacerbated a situation that was pertaining pre-COVID. Our economy was in recession. In the early stages of COVID, Moody's downgraded us, so we are now in essentially junk status. That has been put on the back burner to a certain extent because of COVID. But as soon as we start looking at the revival of the economy and we start going out into the market to raise funds, because we're going to have to do that, we don't have sufficient funds internally. The downgrade is going to hit us. The impact of the downgrade is going to hit us. We're also going to be competing for funds with other jurisdictions, other countries that are also wanting to rebuild post-COVID. And they have they're in a better position than we were. We are, because pre-COVID, they were not in recession while we were. So I think the critical stuff here is to make the necessary interventions in the economy to ensure that investors feel confident to invest here, that their funds will be safe, they'll be able to repatriate the dividends. We don't send out messages like expropriation without compensation. We don't send out messages like threatening the independence of the reserve of the central bank. And we government gets on point. The president actually aligns his cabinet to essentially a single mantra, and that mantra has got to be to create the environment for investment and growth that we can then structure to be inclusive and equitable. And without that, we obviously Edward being at SARS is great, and SARS is getting its act together again and rebuilding after the Zuma years. But Edward can't do much without economic growth and tax revenue.
And on that point,
those are the critical issues.
On that point, Kaz, I want to bring Keith Engel in here, because he's worked both inside Treasury and he's now working in the private sector, advising businesses and very closely dealing with SARS. Keith, what do you see as the major revenue challenges that face Edward Keyswetter at this time? We had you on a panel not too long ago talking about the fact that multinational corporations are making losses. They're not going to be paying a lot of tax over the next few years. So he really is faced with a bit of a Sisyphean task, the SARS commissioner, in increasing tax compliance in an environment like this.
Yeah, I think, well, first, I mean, I go where Kaz is gone. I think the first thing you need is you've got to get growth. You can only tax when you have an economy. There's got to be revenue in the private sector. So challenge one is growth. And he said that in even beforehand. He said, your growth is going down. You're going into recession. And no matter what we do, that's going to hurt our numbers. And you can see that. What you're talking about is the companies that were profitable before, the multinationals, the large guys, he could at least count on them. But now those are going to suddenly generate a large amount of losses through the system. So first is growth. And the second issue is, okay, maybe there's growth in the real economy. But then his second problem is that going to translate to tax revenue? Forgetting any changes of law, how is this going to change taxpayer behavior? Post this event, will they be less compliant? People will be more desperate. And what we've already seen in numbers as the desperation came in, people not paying over PAYE, people not paying over VAT. So there will be a compliance problem. And the moment you try to get compliance, they'll say we're in trouble. So he's got to make sure that the people are complying that were previously complying. And then the other issue is we still have a chunk of the economy that there is money being made behind closed doors that he's not collecting. And that evasion issue is quite large.
Well, that's the problem as well. He's got cabinet colleagues who think that the illicit tobacco trade is fine because it's at least leading to some economic activity somewhere. To hell with the fiscus and the fact that we're not collecting any of that that sin tax. Peter Attard-Montolto, you wrote a very interesting column this week in Business Day talking about the credibility gap perhaps being the biggest issue ahead of this budget. Can you just elaborate on why you see the credibility issues as being the most important for private sector investors?
I think that's really what investors are watching for today in the budget, is how you basically close this huge hippo's jaws that the finance minister was tweeting about over the weekend. This big divergence between revenue on the one hand and expenditure on the other, but do it in a credible way. I do worry a bit that Treasury tries to maybe consolidate a little bit too fast, maybe a little bit too much reliance on tax hikes. They might try and pencil in a very weak economy. And also try and push forward a little bit too much even on expenditure cuts, which I think will be very hard really to push through, given they've already eliminated so much of the sort of free fat around the system. And this is really the crucial issue of allowing the debt to stabilize over time in a way that investors can buy into, but also people like the IMF. And I think the crucial thing that's happening right now into and then through into the end of July is that Treasury is now in negotiations on this fiscal framework with the IMF to get the dispersal of the RFI, this $4.2 billion. And this isn't normally the case around a budget event, obviously, but where you have to have a letter of intent laying out what you're going to do to achieve that credibility. And so this is a much larger game, if you like, which this budget is playing into with a lot, much larger set of axes. And I think where there's been a lot of pushback from the IMF on this credibility point of being able to sustainably stabilize the debt to GDP level.
And I think for credibility, one also needs to have a look at how the test cases of the public sector wage bill, which I think surprised a lot of people in the February budget, and things like SAA are dealt with. Matthew, on the issue of the public sector wage bill, COSATU was quite surprised in February when the 160 billion rand in cuts from the public sector wage bill was announced, either by freezes or other mechanisms. Do you expect to be surprised again in a few hours' time?
No, this time we won't be surprised because we've been having engagements. The wage bill right now is at the Public Service Bargaining Council for arbitration. I think government really blundered in February by coming to the Public Service Bargaining Council the night before the budget speech and just said we want to pull out, didn't put alternative offers on the table. If they had really just come to us in October last year, I'm sure we'd have easily found each other, because there's no union which wants to see government collapse. If government collapses, the first person to suffer will be workers, pensioners, etc. But I think, to be honest with you, Michael, it'll be very difficult for our members to accept a compromise for the 2020 agreement, given how poisoned the atmosphere has been. But I think we can easily find each other for the next three-year wage agreement, and we can easily find ways to address the macro savings objectives. We don't want to see government collapse. We've got a vested interest in it, but it's about how you negotiate. And right now, members are quite angry. People often view public servants as some sort of creature which sits in a cave somewhere. They figure that it's 70,000 nurses, it's 20,000 doctors, it's 200,000 police officers, it's 70,000 correctional service officers, etc. And many of those have been working throughout the lockdown, putting their life and limb at risk. Many of them have actually tragically been dying. So I think if government wants to motivate them and to honor them, they need to honor their existing agreement. And it's not an exorbitant agreement, as despite the public discourse. It's inflation plus 1% or 0.5% or 0%. It's the lowest in many years. The public sector wage bill has been stable at 35% of the budget for the last 10 years. But having said that, we think there are ways to address the crisis. But I think maybe the last thing, Michael, is that for us, if government doesn't address the 10% of the budget we lose to corruption and wasteful expenditure every year, according to the Auditor General, if it doesn't find ways to grow the economy and then to grow the revenues, then we're just playing with the chairs on the Titanic. We have to deal with those underlying causes.
Absolutely, Matthew. We're previewing the big winter budget. Peter Otard-Montalto, we just heard from Matthew Parks, the parliamentary coordinator for COSATU, about the public sector wage bill and the fact that what public sector unions are asking for isn't too much. I mean, CPI plus 1%. This is in an environment where most in the private sector have seen an absolute freeze on wages, not just for this year, but for several years in the build-up. And many have even lost their jobs or had wages reduced. In an environment like this, surely we should be talking about everyone sharing the pain equally. And I understand that there are nurses and doctors and police workers on the front lines, but there's a whole layer of a middle manager and upper middle manager and lower upper middle management in the Purcell scheme of things that lead to a lot of bloat in the public sector wage bill.
Well, this is the real problem. If you look at the expenditure side of the budget, there hasn't been a massive macro problem that's led to this sort of grinding higher in debt to GDP over time. It's really come actually on the revenue side. But I think the problem, coming back to this credibility issue, is you can't hike taxes here and expect to raise a huge amount of more money to pay into SOE bailouts, to pay for public sector wage increases. And as a result, at the fiscal cliff edge, with a local bond market that is basically on the edge of indigestion and breaking, with the Saab not willing to provide a free lunch, I think, until after the bond market has broken, you have to take some pretty difficult decisions. And certainly the public sector wage bill can't be all of that. As Matthew said, there are a lot of people who do, you know, are not on huge wages and who are providing vital public services. But there's still this key layer of middle management, particularly at the provincial level, particularly in some departments in government, where you can see some trimming of numbers, I think. And this is the real debate, I think, that that the public sector unions have tried to avoid, is to try and keep it around wage increases, whereas actually really it's probably about still trimming some numbers. And that's the same debate that's going on in SOEs as well, particularly at ESCOM. But you can't just, I think, achieve sustainability just through keeping wage increases flat. There's going to have to be some trimming as part of a much broader realignment of the expenditure side of the budget.
I think, Miriam, I want to bring you in on this issue, and it's a broad idea of what austerity actually means. And I think there are many, particularly, who attack Treasury on the left, some heterodox economists who say that we've been strangled by austerity. To me, rising deficits and increasing government expenditure are not austerity. What characterizes recent budgets for you?
Yeah, I wrote about this when I wrote about the budget in February in Business Maverick, which is that this is not austerity. Austerity doesn't mean rising deficits and actually pretty much rising spending in relation to GDP. You know, at the most extreme was Greece, comes to mind, where pensions are cut, salaries are cut, public servants are cut. You know, we have to do everything we can so we don't end up in a Greece type of situation. Now, that isn't the only form of austerity, but we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which it's possible. So when people are saying we don't want to lose our sovereignty, they're absolutely right. But we shouldn't hand over our sovereignty. And that means we've got to get a grip on spending and start getting revenue flowing again. And do whatever we can in our power to make sure that communities and businesses are able to sustain the return to work now. Now, just on the wage story, and this is also something that I've been writing about, is, you know, where I would agree with Matthew, and I'll get into trouble, I guess, with Tito, is with the minister, is there was a three-year agreement, and there's a reason why you have a three-year agreement. As far as I know, I think it's over now, but you do it to create stability in the relationship. And what I would really like to see in the public sector negotiations is a longer-term strategy. There has been a tendency of racing into negotiations 5 minutes before, you know, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, weeks or maybe a month or two before an agreement is coming up. And that is not the way to run a complex process like this. What needs to happen is there needs to be a long range view as to how we get on a pathway in relation to sustainable salaries, performance, right skill, right job, more people at the coal face, maybe less paper pushing, more people at the coal face, how we make sure that the leadership that is meant to be in place. For example, COCTA requires certain kinds of leadership in municipalities. School principals, there's new rules around the appointment of school principals that the ministry has put out. Those need to be, it needs to be done to make sure that we get better performance. If that were happening, I think we would see something different. And I think creditors would, what people really want to see is they just want to know, are you on a pathway to health? It doesn't mean you're healthy today. It means, are you on a pathway, and do you have a grip on this pathway? Because, you know, plenty of developing countries are way behind us in relation to their health, but we're not moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and that impacts your future ability to repay, and that's understandably why creditors want to understand that. Matthew, to come back to you on the issues that Miriam and Peter have raised, would Kosatu be open to that kind of give and take in the relationship here, considering that it is in the public sector certainly the most powerful union still, and that's where the seat of power lies, yet we see a delay in some of those reforms, like you know, the right people in the right job at school principal level, for example. How open are you as a labor union to these talks?
No, look, we're quite open. We can see where the trajectory is going on many fronts, from the state to the broader economy, the SOEs. And we know if those things go south, if you go the Greece route, as Miriam's saying, the first ones to suffer will be workers, will be pensioners, will be the families who depend upon public services. So we're quite keen to fix things, but it's about having genuine engagements. It's not easy to convince unions to accept a three-year agreement because they often are a bit suspicious of it. But then when the three-year agreement in the last year, government runs away from it, makes it difficult. We had intervened in ESCOM because we could see ESCOM was heading off the cliff late last year, early this year, and we had offered numerous compromises on our part on many fronts, including very difficult issues like the headcount and so on, because we're looking at how to save workers' jobs in the immediate impact, but also the broader economy, the broader society. So we accept there is a need for everybody to compromise, to sacrifice and so on. And I'll, you know, having talked to my colleagues in the Public Service Bargaining Council about what they're willing to put on the table for the next 3 years, I was quite surprised at how much they're willing to compromise. But I think the bottom line, any worker was to know that, will my salary be protected from inflation? Can I at least get an inflation increase? We're willing to look at a sliding scale, and we agree with Peter completely. In fact, in our proposal to the Public Service Bargaining Council, we've said that the management in the public service, but even more so in the entities, and even worse in the SOEs, there's a huge ballooning what managers earn. So you have a CEO, Michael, at Mgeni Water Board, who earns R1 million every single month. You have 800 managers at ESCOM earning R2 million a year. So that's the kind of fat which must be dealt with. And if you can deal with that kind of fat, you can hold those who have stolen to book. It then makes a broader compromise much easier to sell to a nurse, to a teacher, etc. But we wouldn't want to see the state fail. We're not anarchists, but you want to make sure that ordinary workers are already struggling. And most workers support about 7 relatives who are unemployed. And that's going to increase as we see retrenchments gaining speed.
Kaz, as we round up this conversation, are you confident as business in the ways in which these test cases of dealing with the very politically knotty issue of public sector wages and also of SAA, considering that we're now looking at reviving a moribund airline in the middle of a global pandemic where global travel and tourism are months, some say years away from returning to health. Are you confident in the way these things have been dealt with that we'll be able to get some of these political knotty and thorny issues over the line?
Look, I think that we're not totally comfortable yet. Let me pick up from Matthew. I think perhaps a good starting point is that none of us want to see the state fail, right? Business doesn't want to see the state fail either. I think the state needs to also understand that the state shouldn't fail. And then we at least have a starting point. But I think that we're not seeing the sort of decisiveness that we need from the state on some of these issues. And I think both Matthew and I think Miriam also mentioned that compromises and trade-offs are going to have to be necessary across the board, not just from labor, not just from government, but all of us. And I think what COVID has done is to a certain extent given us the opportunity to recalibrate the economy and to recalibrate the way we actually engage with each other, so that we begin to appreciate that we essentially at a T junction. And we need to make the right turn here. And we need to make the right choices. Now, some of those are going to be unpalatable. We're going to have to prioritize stuff that we might not all be happy with. But those are the sorts of interactions and engagements that are necessary. And I think if we can give that sort of joint leadership and brave leadership to this, I think it begins to put us onto a path and begins to send a message to investors and to the multilateral agencies that we are taking the hard decisions to get onto that path.
The hard decisions and the compromises, Keith Engel, to bring you in here, I think many in the private sector, particularly small businesses, would say they've made compromises. The trade-off for them has been during the lockdown that they've lost their earnings, they've lost their income, their businesses have closed down. and that very little seems to be given on the other side of the social contract. And taxpayers are the ones who eventually, or not eventually, who do fund government and its programs and the state at the end of the day. And I agree there should be compromise, but surely we need to see more from the state and more from the public sector.
You know, I agree with that. I think it's forgetting that the COVID, I think the point is that that feeling was beforehand. If you took a look really from 2013 on, we started seeing more and more tax increases, and the most the government was slowing its growth and spending, but the government wasn't coming to the table. And so at this point, the private sector was already saying before the crisis, we've given enough. We're not going to give more. And to be honest with you, I don't think people are in a position anymore. Now, you could talk about a wealth tax or a few little trimmings here and there. But even then, you know, we've already done so much of indirect wealth taxes that you're just not able to. And I think the problem is there's that elephant in the room. There's a portion of the government that has been unwilling to yield. So, for instance, yes, the wage increase issue, that was, you know, I guess the private sector said you're at least trying, but it really was the wrong message. The real problem was we have a lot of patronage in the system, and we have a lot of SOEs that are failing. Look at SAA. It looks like Gordon is trying to keep it alive. Now, maybe people will be willing to come to the table who have surpluses if they see serious compromises on the other side. But the most you're seeing from government is a promise that we'll do slightly better down the road. And in that line, the trust is gone. And I think that's your real problem here. And what will show up in the trust is people will move toward evasion.
Keith Engel, the CEO of the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners, thank you very much for your time. To Dr. Miriam Altman, National Planning Commissioner, Kaz Kavadia, CEO of Business Unity South Africa, Matthew Parks, Parliamentary Coordinator for COSATU, and we also have Peter Attard Montalto, Head of Capital Markets Research at Intellidex. Over to you, Minister Mboweni. The time to shake the baobab has arrived.